How are you again? Yeah, we did a little thing about Velvet Insane, their brand new start.
Yep, everyone enjoyed the song and the music.
Yeah, I mean, I can say that I feel it's a pop rock kind of thing that, you know, hooks you in a way.
I like songs that actually sometimes simpler is better. Mm. I mean, if you think about some of the biggest Kiss songs I was involved with or that we performed, some of them were really simple, from Rock and Roll Night to Lick It Up to Heaven's on Fire. You know, even a song like Forever is not that complicated, but hooky songs are always a good feeling.
And you see that with a lot of rock bands, you know, AC/DC, Kiss, and even mm-hmm. some metal bands, that is, the simpler songs is the one that hooks
yes.
the audience.
Yes. Exactly.
I usually start all the way from the early beginnings. You were born in Brooklyn, New York.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and grew up there too.
I grew up in Brooklyn and Queens, so I'm a New York boy, and actually that was a good thing because of all the access to so many bands came to play, and of course the record industry back in the 60s and 70s were absolutely, and 80s probably, New York based, you know, in a big way, you know. All the major labels were in New York City, so all good.
But how was it when you grew up there? You went to school, and yeah, it was cool going in school. Not cruel to be in school. Were you a good boy?
yeah, honestly, you know, I wasn't a terrible student. I actually realized that it's important to have, you know, good skills with your English, and I learned typing. I don't remember why I wound up in one of those classes, but that turned out to be very valuable with everything being, you know, the computer, because I do like using a desktop or a laptop where I could really type. But and then they wanted me in school, actually, they wanted me to kind of do an instrument, you know, like for the orchestra, because they did a music kind of like ability test, you know, where they were listening. I forget how they did the test, but they just, I think it's called like a music aptitude or something. Mm. But I couldn't go because I had to go to Hebrew school, so I'd be bar mitzvahed at 13. And it's kind of funny that they wanted me to play. I was a tall guy, and even when I was young, I was very tall. So they wanted me to play stand-up bass, you know, because it's a big instrument, you know. I always wonder, like, what would have happened to my career or my abilities on guitar and everything if I did that. But in the end, it didn't matter that I didn't go to the music program in my high school and all. I wound up just playing music so much on my own, you know. I did take lessons from a local record shop, had a guitar player guy that taught, and I had a good, you know, it came easy to me, and I had a good ear. There's a lot of people in my family, obviously, that are also musicians, and there's people even like that I wasn't that aware. I knew my uncle and some other cousins played, but I found out not that long ago that one of my uncles wound up being a violin player, and he was asked to go on tour in Europe back in the, you know, 40s or whatever, and his, you know, fiance said, if you go, I'm not gonna be here, you know what I mean, kind of thing. So the fact that there's a lot of people in the family that were musical, but it really was my drive and my dedication to studying the bands that I loved and learning guitar and just trying to figure out how to be valuable as a musician, because it is a hard profession. You know, you really do need to, it isn't as simple as a athlete or a, you know, someone that goes to school to be a professor. You know, you're going to get a diploma. There is nothing like that in the music business. And an athlete, obviously you do great in the early kind of leagues that you play in, and then you're going to be in the majors. You're going to be in the professional league, you know. A musician really has to kind of navigate so many different things to become noticed and fit in. And sometimes it's just so amazing when it lines up. And for example, my opportunity to to join KISS. You know, it was really unusual, but amazing, and obviously turned out to be quite a wonderful thing for my career.
Yeah, we will come to that part also. I just now, you already mentioned that you had a lot of music in your family. Was it there the music interest came to you, and how did you discover? Because way back then it was there. Today you see everything on Spotify, YouTube, and so on. Way back then it was maybe your brother, your family, your uncle, something that made you discover different artists. And
well, I you know, you share albums and things back then. A lot. Vinyl was really popular, and I had a tape recorder. I used to borrow someone's record and actually record it, so I'd have a copy. So I was doing, you know, my version of like how everybody shares music way back then. I still have some of those tapes. It's kind of funny. I would have Hendrix and other bands that I may not have had the actual vinyl for. I was really big into the tape recorders and everything, but you know, music was on TV. You had to watch all the shows where the Rolling Stones would perform or the Who, and I got to go to concerts when I was young too, because again, as I mentioned, New York, everybody came to play in New York, you know. So I really immersed myself in music. I had a friend in Jackson Heights when I moved to Queens that they always played albums down in this one guy's basement, and I would listen, and that's where I'd be exposed to some different kinds of bands that I may not have listened to originally. And then I started actually finding players to jam with, you know, and that was that. There were some really talented people in the neighborhood. I actually released something that was recorded from 74 called KKB, which is the initials of the three guys. And if I look back at that, I mean, at a very young age, I was just like 21. I'm very impressed with what I was trying to do. You know, I know I could play it better now, but considering the year and what my experiences were before that, I was really proud of the fact that I was you know, being creative and it still kind of sounds good. So that's pretty impressive to me.
Yeah, I listened to that the other day, actually. It's on Spotify, I released, and, you know, I liked it. It's like, groove, 70s groove. It would hold up today also.
I know. Maybe. My main bass player who created most of the songs, I only co-wrote one of them. He was very talented. I'm still good friends with him, Mike Katz, and he still lives in Queens. And we always keep in touch. He's a big Grand Funk fan, so he's come to see me quite a few times with Grand Funk. But he's just a really gifted guy. And then we did that new song for that project. So I keep in touch with some of my earliest people. I just spoke with a keyboard player that I worked with when I was in Maryland. We couldn't hook up this time, but I've gotten together with him. And I remember my first gigs. He was in my first band that I ever played professionally. Some of the other people from the neighborhood that knew me don't bother really much with me. They're aware of what I do, and they may be Facebook friends. But some of the others I actually get together with, and it's really kind of fun because, you know, what I usually get from them is that I'm no different than I was when I was, you know, 20, you know, which is pretty flattering to me. But I think some other people are probably uncomfortable with it, and they might think I'm affected in some way because I've had, a resume with some famous bands. But I see myself as the same person, you know.
Yeah. So. Otherwise, growing up in the 60s, 70s, there was a lot going on also. It was like the Vietnam War, the Watergate, the hippie music. You mentioned Hendrix coming up, and even the birth of metal.
Right.
Was it something that you noticed in, you know, the big city, or you think affected somewhat your musical
way? I think all of that was very, very special to me. I think now, obviously, every generation has their stressful cultural and political times, as we know. But when it comes to the music explosion that was happening, you know, I'm very aware of what a lot of young people listen to nowadays, and I totally scratch my head. You know, you know what I mean? You know, the people that like some of the EDM or rap music or whatever thing, you know, it's their culture, and I respect that, but I don't have to listen to it. They don't have to listen to rock and roll if they don't want to.
Yeah, exactly.
I listen to a lot of different things, actually. But the point is, I do feel that classic rock will be a genre, and I'm being very broad with that. That's from the Beatles to Kiss to the Rolling Stones to the Who to Led Zeppelin to everything, you know, to even Van Halen and beyond and Nirvana, you know, is, you could practically call them classic rock already, of course. But all those bands, I think, will have a footprint of moving forward, you know, in people's musical diet, you know. So it even though you can't count the record sales of rock music the way it used to be, but everybody's listening to music differently now anyway. But I just think there's something really special about you know, the era that I kind of grew up in and the music that came out of it. That's all. So Kiss will never die, even if they stop touring. Led Zeppelin will never go away. Jimi Hendrix will still always be revered as a super talent pioneer of electric guitar playing. These things will never stop. Never.
And that's a good thing. Can't erase the history. I shouldn't do it either. So.
Yeah, but look, there's no doubt. Look, we're all flesh and blood, and human beings are all, you know, our biology is the same, and our little feel-good kind of triggers and our emotions are all wired very similarly. Now, not everybody likes chocolate ice cream. Some might like vanilla, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no doubt that good music or some of the bands that I mentioned, there was something, you know, just really, really, they dialed in a certain thing. You know, the people who pick on Kiss or don't get Kiss or complain about Gene and Paul because they don't have the original members, you know, they're forgetting the bigger picture. Look what these guys created. You know, it's really incredible. You know, and that band, marketing whizzes, merchandise kings, you know, whatever, however you want to criticize them as on a business level, potentially, if you wanted to. But ultimately, musically, or creatively, what they have built is very, very powerful, and it affects so many people in a very positive way. And that, I don't care if you get turned off to the band or you don't like the music, you have to respect that. You know what I mean? But obviously, most people that are listening to you guys know that I'm a supporter of Kiss, of course, and proud of it. But and they probably are too. Okay, but you know, there's always the people that never got Kiss and they never understand it, or they did and then they, you know, kind of fell off the appreciation page. You know,
all kinds of people out there.
Yeah.
But then, was it always rock music for you when you was, you know, in the '70s and started your first band? Was it rock that was your? Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I definitely. The Beatles was my real start.
Mm.
You know, the British Invasion, then you got the Who, and then you got Led Zeppelin, and you got the, you know, Rolling Stones. And it really, really quite, it was a very fertile time for music. You know, there were bands like, even though I'm not like a huge progressive rock fan, but I did really like Yes.
Mm.
I like King Crimson. And I there's a guy that I know who owns a local restaurant that I love. And he's sending me lots of YouTube links to bands that he loves. From Marillion to other bands that I'm not that familiar with, but he's a big progressive rock guy, and I give it a listen. I'm checking it out, you know. But I did like some progressive bands, and I learned from that, and I incorporated it in my playing. And I also was always a big lover of kind of jazz and kind of the Sinatra and the Rat Pack music, and lately that I listen to a lot of that, and I really enjoy it because it's a little different than rock guitar, so I learned from it that way, you know.
I know you mentioned Beatles. They, you know, were huge in US, but then they got some controversy. I don't know if it was during your time with that Bigger Than Jesus thing up from Lennon, was it, I think, said something. Okay, your first recording, was that the KKB? Or your first?
That would have been the first thing that was like actually recorded, that was semi-professional, you know, a reasonable studio and all right, red light is on, go, you know, yes, that was my first thing. And then I got to do a couple of sessions in New York. And then really, I guess the first big real record I did was working with Blackjack and Michael Bolton, you know, and we got a record deal. And that was kind of really exciting. I went to Florida. We recorded at a famous studio with a pretty well-known producer, Tom Dowd. And he worked with Eric Clapton and the Allman Brothers, and he was involved in some really amazing records. I had some really amazing experiences working with some famous producers through the years.
Yeah, but before that, you were touring with Meatloaf.
You were asking about recording.
Yeah.
I did go on a...
I know, but I wanted to ask about Meatloaf. How did you get into that? Because it was after the Bat Out of Hell album, I got it correctly, and that album went huge, say at least.
The Meatloaf record came out, they got a record deal, and it was a big struggle for them, apparently. And, you know, as you all know, my brother's just a few years older than me, 4 years older, and he saw that they were auditioning guitar players and they wanted two guitar players, which was kind of convenient. And we auditioned. And I understand, actually, they weren't that certain about me, ironically enough. And when my brother convinced them that I should be it, which is a good thing, I was the one that would learn every Todd Rundgren riff. Because, you know, Todd Rundgren, who I'm a big fan of, he played all the lead guitar on the Bat Out. He produced the record, too.
Yeah.
And some of the leads are really wild. Todd played great on the record. I don't think Todd Rundgren knew it was going to be, you know, this 50 million selling album. And the next thing I know, we're on tour. I know the manager was happy with what I was doing because I would learn, you know, if I had that solo in that song, I would play it as close to Todd Rundgren as possible. But the band was huge, 9 people. You know, Bob and I were Killer and Pretty Boy. That tour was not easy for anybody. And I know I was really, really stressed a lot of the time. Meatloaf was complicated. I mean, you know, he's a dramatic guy, and I really do like him a lot. He's really a very emotional, passionate singer and artist. Great actor, too. You know that. He's done a lot of great acting.
Yeah.
But to go from basically being booed on the first gig to, of course, selling out an arena tour, that's a big jump in a very short amount of time. You know, I think it was only in like 3 or 4 months, all of a sudden, once radio picked up on it, you know. There was a real pivoting moment when we played the CBS record convention. It was CBS back then, which is now probably Sony or whatever, Universal, I forget. And the next thing I know, there's people like Billy Joel there watching us. And as soon as they saw that Meatloaf band, I'm still in touch with quite a few of the guys from that band. They got it, and then they pumped in the money and got the, you know, you can spend all the money in the world to get a radio station to play it, but then the people have to respond.
You know?
And they did. They loved the Meatloaf album, and the next thing I know, Meatloaf, we're able to fill an arena and tour the world. So it went from struggling to a huge success in a very short period of time. And that was my only tour with Meatloaf. What's great is that there's a CD, usually most of the newer copies for the past like 10 years of Bat Out of Hell has 2 bonus tracks on it that are live. And those live tracks are that Meatloaf touring band that I described. I'm on the left, my brother's on the right when you listen to it.
Yeah. But it must, you know, big, you are still a young dude, you could say, and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, going to this arena. So I can understand if you're a bit stressed. It was a new experience, but experience that, you know, probably served you well, with what was ahead.
I mean, some of the stress was regarding just Meatloaf being really difficult, and there was just that, like, wow, you go from nothing to, you know, really big success, and everybody's a little bit wound up from it. So it was hard, but I was real proud of that, what we accomplished, and I'm glad there is a recorded, evidence of it that's out there.
Good. And then we came to that. You mentioned Michael Bolton. What shall you say, the first record, with a real studio, good producer. How did that band come together, Black Yak?
Well, that was my first professional record deal. Pretty simple, where Michael, he was a well-known East Coast singer from New Haven, Connecticut. And he put together a really good demo with Johnny Winters on guitar and two songs. And he had somebody shop it around. That's what you would do back then. Mm. And there was a pretty powerful guy over at who was connected with some of the labels who worked with Led Zeppelin and Bad Company. Mm. And he was their attorney, Stephen Weiss. And Steve really loved it and thought that he could get a record deal on Polydor. But he didn't want Michael to be a solo artist. He wanted it to be a band. So that's how I did some gigs with Michael. And the next thing I know, we're finding a drummer and a bass player, and we were Blackjack, you know, and we had a hard time finding a name, but we finally found the name. And they put a lot of money into that first album that looked like a deck of cards. We didn't quite have the magic song to make us a big hit, but, we sold some copies. But by the time we were ready to do the second album, and we did some touring, but the second album, the label already, people were changing, and they didn't have the support for us anymore. So that basically ended. But I kept that relationship with Michael, of course, and wound up touring again with him as a solo artist and doing some work on his records.
Yeah, I've seen that. Then, of course, you were in a lot of his 80s album, I've seen there.
Yeah.
When he, broke through in the world, you could say. Great voice.
And what's interesting, too, though, is that there's always that networking and connection that you don't know how it's going to work in the future. For example, with Blackjack, then I worked with Michael by himself, but then Michael got gigs opening for Bob Seger and the drummer in Bob Seger for those tours. Many tours actually was Don Brewer, who is Grand Funk Railroad. And that's how I met Don, so that many years later in 99 he would be thinking of me on the short list to be in Grand Funk Railroad, so there's always these little connective dots through your career sometimes.
Be careful with your connections and take care of them. You could say it's a lesson.
That's true. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's why it is really good to hopefully, do the best you can with the artist, and you never know who you're going to meet on the way. And then they remember you and use you in the future, So that's it. That was well said by you. Correct.
Yeah. And then I can mention one band you were in, The Good Rats, I've seen.
And it's funny. Yeah. Really, really popular local band in the tri-state area. Tri-state area, you would call New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And that would include Long Island. They came from Long Island, okay? Very popular. They had a Warner Brothers deal, and then they had a falling out with their guitarist and their bass player, and the next thing you know, I'm in the band. And I did that because, look, when I was in Blackjack with Michael, we were, hoping to be big stars, okay? It didn't happen, and it hurt, okay? We had some opportunities. We had a big major record deal. We had a famous producer. The label put a lot of money behind us. We did videos, but it just didn't take off, So when it was all over and a local band offered me something that I could play 3 or 4 times a week, have a weekly salary, be home, and just travel locally, I thought it was a good idea, but I do know it was a bit of a step back for me in a way, because I really did want my own original band and things like that, or be part of something bigger. But I couldn't make The Good Rats any bigger. They were always destined just to be legendary in that area of America, So that's what I did. I toured with them locally for 2 years.
Yeah, you could say it, it was a safe way to get a paycheck and,
still, and
playing. then we come to the story you have probably have told a million times before. I written down you joined the biggest band in the world, Kiss.
It was very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. How did it happen, really?
Well, of course I knew those guys, and we all know that, you know, my brother did some session work for them, and I met Paul Stanley, and we hung out a few times. This is back in the late 70s, you know. But in 84, they wanted me, Paul was trying to reach me to help out on Animalize, okay? And I just, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I thought it was really cool. They needed some guitar riffs on a song or two. I went in the studio, and obviously I did the job well. And then Paul, right before I was done, I don't know what was going on with Mark St. John at the time, but I didn't realize that he was also, besides maybe Paul not being happy about some of the things that he was doing, but was the fact that he started to come down with some condition that made him not be able to play guitar, you know, this arthritic condition. So he just said to me before I left that day, it was really weird, don't cut your hair. You know, it's about shoulder length at the time.
Yeah.
Nothing tremendously long, but, you know, still rock and roll. And I was like, oh, that's a weird thing to say. Don't cut your hair.
made you think or wonder what
you
mean.
Yeah, but I didn't really connect the dots until I got the call. And they said, like, hey, you know, would you be willing to come help us out and come to Europe with us? And fortunately, you know, because of all that traveling with Meatloaf and stuff, I had a passport. I knew what it was to, you know, go to Germany and England and everything like that. So I was pretty thrilled. I was, believe me, happy to be a temporary player, you know what I mean, in the band.
Yeah.
The 2 weeks turned into 6 weeks, the entire European tour. Now, right now, we're celebrating 35 years, you know, which is really mind-blowing, to be quite honest, okay?
Yeah.
So in fact, today, I know you're airing this at a different date, but either way, today was the day we actually did Animalize Live in Detroit. We filmed it for MTV, and that's December 8th. But the fact that I went from, and the day before was when I would be officially a member of the band, because they actually did, after the 6 weeks of Europe, we came to America and toured here, but Mark was on the road with us because they had a contract with him. He was on Animalize. He's featured in the video. He's on the cover or the back cover of Animalize. And they needed to give him a proper opportunity to be the guitar player of the band. But quite honestly, like in sports, you say you have the home advantage. You know what I mean? When your home team is playing. I had the home team advantage by having 6 weeks of experience with playing with them. So they experimented with Mark doing some of it, doing a show. I think he played three times, half of a show, second half of the show, full show. And then they sent him home. It was pretty wild. And that's when they gave me a contract to be an actual member of KISS, not a temporary, you know, fill-in guy. So
it
was
big day.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, real exciting.
And then after Animalize and all that touring, I can say that Animalize was the first album I got myself with KISS. I listened to it KISS before, but it was the first vinyl I got myself.
Right.
And
it's
so,
a good record, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I was exploring quite a bit of it for the KISS cruise, as you're probably aware, and I did a nice medley of songs from it with the band on the cruise, and it went over unbelievable. It got so much great press. I was so proud of it, because it's not an album that they ever look at. And to be honest, past, I think maybe we did one of the songs or two of the songs in Asylum, but we really just kept moving forward during my years. So many of those songs were never played again.
Yeah, because next album, Asylum, there you're also involved with songwriting.
Yeah, that was exciting.
Yeah,
of course.
Well, how did they come to you and say, okay, write some songs? So did you come with ideas to Gene and Paul and they liked it? And Yeah,
I mean, it's always a complicated process, co-writing with anybody, really, because it's very personal when you're being creative like that. But I remember getting together with Paul and Desmond Child, which was really exciting. I knew Desmond was a great writer even before he did the Bon Jovi stuff, you know, because he co-wrote Heaven's on Fire with Paul. And I had some riff ideas and we'd kick it around. And same thing with Gene. I used to travel with a four-track recorder that I could, if I had an idea, I'd work on it. So it was really interesting actually being creative with them. And it was a great opportunity. The pressure is terrible, though, because you realize that if you have an idea and it doesn't get used, you know, it's like an opportunity that you're missing. And then, of course, if it's used and it makes it on the record, it's not only a financial bonus, but it's also an important credit for your talent. So it's always exciting when it works out.
Yeah, you could maybe say that if it doesn't come in, you can get low, and if it does, you get a confidence boost.
Absolutely.
When it comes in, and you can grow.
Excuse me.
Yeah, it's cool.
So ultimately, having that opportunity was tremendous, and I really, I'm glad they turned to me for riffs. And sometimes it was easier, other times it was harder for me to contribute. But I always, I was always aware that I wanted to, make it happen the best I could. But it's you know, each album was a different struggle to try to figure out what direction we're in and how I can get them excited to finish a song or take the idea and finish it. You know, so it was always an interesting process co-writing with them.
And just a bike question, as I call it, the clothes you used during that time, is it something you would wear today? It was a space, you know, even Mötley Crüe or Osbourne, everyone used that, you know, glam and shirts and, colorful.
I know a lot of people look back at some of that stuff and you know, kind of laugh or pick on it, or they really love it, you know, but they were all very, very appropriate for the times.
Many bands used it as a...
Of course.
Was the thing at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Then in the 80s you have Crazy Nights, and it was more of a... I call it stadium rock.
Yeah, I agree. And Crazy Nights, the single, actually was actually bigger in Europe than it was in America. But I'm really... you know, I know some people love the album, some people criticize it. You know, you could tell there's some keyboards on it and things like that, or it's too pop. But I think it's a great record, and Ron Neverson obviously was making a lot of the choices at the time, but it's a good record. And it really helped when we did the big Monsters of Rock tour, you know, and toured in 88 a lot over in Europe. Quite a few of those songs were featured.
And I can say, we talked earlier about, you know, simple songs or simple catchy songs.
Right.
And I would say that Crazy Night is just that hooks everyone. Yep. It works at any party, basically.
Adam Mitchell, who co-wrote that with Paul, I'm still friends with him. They really, really hit the mark on that. I was real happy. And I love, like, playing it because, again, it's my era, my you know, I'm playing rhythm and lead on it, and that's a great, great feeling. It's a good song.
Hot in the Shade, shall we touch that a bit?
The Lost, sure, and that's like a 30th anniversary now.
Yeah.
You know? Came out in October of 89. Mm. That's crazy. You know, it's actually 15 songs, a lot of different material on it, but there's quite a few really cool vibes on it that I like, and I did a medley from that album as well on the cruise. And I know another time, with, you know, in the future, if we're invited back, which I would presume, and I probably could explore a few different songs from that same album, because there's so many songs, you know. But it's a good record. I enjoy it.
But was it maybe too many? That maybe the criticism about it, that maybe too...
Probably, but I think they got excited that they could put 15 songs on a CD. You couldn't do that on a vinyl. You
know? No, then it can be easy to maybe overdo it, but it is what it is. No,
exactly.
And then you can move on, because I would say that one of my favorite albums is Revenge, because... It was more like you got rougher, dirty, more of a dirty, rough rock sound.
Yep. And, yeah, Bob Ezrin was approached to work with us because we did the God Gave Rock and Roll song for the Bill and Ted movie. They were kind of like just experimenting to see how Bob would work with us. And I was so excited because I always had so much respect for him. Mm. But I know that Gene and Paul were being a little careful because The Elder was a little bit of an unusual record. Yeah. And that was Bob Ezrin. But Destroyer was Bob Ezrin, you know what I mean? Which certainly was a tremendous album for Kiss, you know. So I was excited. I thought Ezrin would do a great job, and he did. And he was a bit of a mad professor. And we were very driven to make a heavy, powerful record. And then during the recording, we're dealing with a horrible tragedy of having our drummer being ill and eventually dying in the same year of recording that record. It was pretty difficult in many ways, but the record and the music really was very triumphant, for sure.
Do you feel that Eric Carr's passing did, you know, is something you can notice, it affected the recording? How it sounded, maybe.
Well, on the day after the funeral, when we all got back to L.A. to get back to work, I was like the first one to record, and we were actually working on that Car Jam 81. Hmm. So it was hard. It was hard for me, but in the same way, I felt that was a really great tribute to him, and I'm real proud of that. The fact that he was on the record by us, you know, taking those old tracks and overdubbing on them, you know.
I like that. And then reunion happened, you know, with makeup and all, but you still released an album in 97 after you left the band. So how...
Well, we were recording.
Yeah, you were, you know, recording
you,
it
you
during
the live three, which obviously came out after the Revenge Tour, which was a great record. But and of course there was Unplugged, which was a tremendous record too. But the Unplugged forced the reunion, you know. And before the reunion, we were working on Carnival of Souls because, you know, the band had a record deal, and I do feel that Gene and Paul were being cautious with Ace and Peter because they didn't know if things would really work out where they'd be able to agree to go on tour. So we were moving ahead with Carnival Souls just in case, you know. Mm. And then, of course, they all agreed and they signed their contracts and the promoters came. And all of a sudden, there it is, the reunion, you know. So Carnival Souls was finished prior to them touring, but couldn't come out until they were done with that first big tour. And then that was the end of my years with the band, and Eric Singer, at least temporarily. Of course, we all know he went back in the group, but that's how it worked out. You know, it was time for the reunion, and then it was time for the makeup to stay on, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And it was time for Tommy to replace Ace because they needed someone that could be the spaceman. That would not have been as easy for me, nor maybe proper for me, if you get what I mean. I certainly had my own identity in the band and represented a completely different guitar playing in Kiss, where, you know, Tommy is a great spaceman. If you can, you know, understand that's his role. I think he does a great job of it.
Well, that's also, I think we talked about Kiss earlier, was that Kiss is more than just the members. It's more of, you know, it's the characters. It's not
exactly
who is the characters, maybe. And Tommy was suited for Spaceman better than you. It was the simple...
Yeah, it would have been hard for me to do that. But I will also add, you know, I always did miss being in the band because I did have a good chemistry with Gene and Paul. But if their model, as I like to call it, is the band and makeup, Tommy's a better choice than me, absolutely. Mm.
So there were, you know, were you bummed or was it no hard feelings there?
No, I understood it. I you know, the stress at the time of the possibility, would they ask me? That would have been around 2000, 2001, something like that. Mm. I was pretty happy working with Grand Funk, and that was a new thing for me. But I also knew I could just be me in Grand Funk. I didn't have to suddenly wear someone else's makeup or assume the role of Ace's playing, you know. And that I was always like, kind of like, well, I'd love to be in the band, but like, wow, you know, now I'd have to sound much more like Ace probably. And I don't know. It just, it never actually came up, you know, legitimately for me to, really try to figure it out. But of course I was aware they could ask me. So it was a little funny thought process in my brain, but it turned, you know, things worked out the way they were supposed to. Eric's done a tremendous job, of course, as the Catman, and Tommy with his, you know, Tommy does have a good strong voice too, so that helps out, you know, and Eric sings. So I really enjoyed it. I got to watch a full show on the cruise, and I did enjoy the show. I enjoyed the way they always put that version of Kiss plays together. And I really loved sitting in with them, of course, on the Sail Away show. It was a lot of fun. Mm. And then we'll see what happens at the very, very end. Obviously, there should be that opportunity that, you know, I'd be involved at the end. So, you know, it's going to be an exciting 2020 and 21.
Yeah. Also, I came to think, how did and do you approach playing? For example, when you were in Kiss, how did you approach playing Ace songs, like from the 70s and stuff? Were you trying to make your thing, or was it, you know, trying to do as good as you could with his style?
I always, whenever I've done, and I do the same kind of thing with Grand Funk, because Mark Farner had some signature leads in many of the big hit songs. And my approach as a guitar player is always, if I'm now in a band and I'm representing the guitars, to like show respect to the what I call the signature riffs. Some things that Ace did I didn't feel was what I play best, but I was never told to play it note for note, as you call it. Okay. You know, if you see me do a Beatles song, I'll try to do the Beatles song note for note for the George Harrison riff or whoever played the lead, you know, because I love the Beatles so much. But when it came to Kiss, they never needed me to necessarily do it exactly the same. There were some songs I remember I learned as close as I could, and other songs that I would learn it, like 75% would be the Ace riffs the way I hear it, and then I would take my own liberty, I would say. But it's funny when I see Tommy play it, because I see that he's perfected what Ace played, you know what I mean? And I could respect that. I also find it interesting seeing him play some of my solos, you know what I mean? Because he's not playing with a Floyd Rose, you know, the whammy bar thing for Crazy Nights. So he has to approach the solo differently, you know, when they do that song. So it's similar, though. I didn't do Ace note for note, and Tommy doesn't do me note for note, and it's okay. But he really does Ace's very similar, absolutely.
He feels then. Then after Kiss, I noticed a band called Union. Hello, Union, you had.
Yeah.
Two releases under a few years.
Yeah.
Anything about that band? I thought, worth mentioning.
Now I'm not in Kiss and not wondering, you know, it's, you know, after 12 years, it's kind of like shocking. Like, what do I do, you know? And I wasn't really sure what to do. The band did pay me. Gene and Paul kept Eric and I on salary for another year, which was really great. And that served two purposes, besides it being a good cushion financially for us. But it also, just in case something terrible happened with that tour, they had a band. You know what I mean? Because Kiss never stopped. You noticed that, right?
Yeah.
There are many big bands that just all of a sudden they go away for 5, 10, 20 years, and then suddenly they regroup. You know, Kiss never stopped. So anyway, that took some pressure off. But It was Larry Mazur who managed Kiss in some of my years, 90 to 95, I think, who suggested John Corabi as being someone that I could do some writing and maybe put a band together with. And John and I musically were very compatible. The chemistry was there. So we found a terrific drummer and bass player. And next thing you know, we were off and running with a record deal. And this is back when the independent labels existed. Mm. I don't feel we got the best opportunities, but I'm very proud of the two records we made. And we did a live DVD and a live CD as well. So there's lots of music out there that you can hear from us. But I really very proud of the music. And maybe one day John and I will revisit it and have a union reunion. You know, we'll see.
It was a good time. It didn't really break through, but a good time. You made three, I can mention that you have made three solo albums, Audiodog 2001, Transformer 2003, and Beaky 3 2010.
Right.
Was it just, okay, now I have songs for a solo album, or did it work?
Well, I was really driven. Once Union, we tried and tried, and things weren't getting better for us. You know, we didn't get that special opportunity where, you know, that would make us want to continue. So we all kind of, you know, we didn't like break up like, you know, I hate you, goodbye. You know, it was just like, well, there's not a lot of opportunities for the band. So we didn't continue. And I decided to do a solo record. And that's when Grand Funk actually approached me about touring with them. But I did Audio Dog out of a lot of songs I had left over that didn't make it with Kiss, didn't make it with Union. And I just put together a record, you know. I liked doing it. I sold it myself. That was very, very kind of not that not uncommon at that time. But I realized that I had enough of a fan base that I don't need to have a label front me money or anything. And if I have to sell it from my car, you know, that's my joke. I'd sell it out of the trunk of my car, you know.
Yeah.
But I sold enough to make me inspired enough to go ahead and do Transformer. And I had similar success with it. And then it took quite a while until I did the third record, but it took a lot longer to record that record. And I had a lot of very special guests on BK3, from Gene Simmons to his son, Nick, Eric Singer, Doug Feiger from The Knack, and Steve Lukather from Toto. Corabi, of course, singing a really, really powerful song on there. So that record, Tobias Sammet, actually from Avantasia, and Ed Guy. But that one took me almost like 4 years to finish. And I'm still proud of that record. There's still good, great songs that I'm proud of. You know, then the record business changed quite a bit, and I didn't know what to do about moving forward with new music. But I am hoping in 2020 to record some new things and maybe some old things with the guys that I did the cruise with, because that band with Todd Kearns and Brent Fitz and Zach Throne, they sing great, and they all play amazing, and they totally get me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
musically.
So
I'm really looking forward to that.
But when it comes to songwriting for you, can ideas for, you know, a tune, a riff come, you know, in middle of the night or in your car, or do you have your own studio where you go in and have sessions and work things?
I can actually just write a song sometimes just fooling around on the guitar. Like lots of times when I watch TV, the TV's on and I'm watching, but I start playing a little bit on the guitar, and the next thing I know, oh, this sounds kind of interesting. Let me mute the television, you know, and the next thing I know, I'm just recording it on my iPhone, you know, the idea. And then I might look at it again later, or sometimes even like really formulate it quite a bit in that, you know, half hour that I discover it. So there was one song that I wrote just prior to rehearsing for the Kiss Cruise 9 that I played a couple of the guys in the band, and they were really digging it. I was so excited because I also had the desire of thinking like, oh, maybe we can finish this and record it, you know, but there was no time with trying to put together a really big, you know, powerful set for the cruise, you know, but it was fun at least doing that. And I'm going to pick that, you know, I'll pick up from there in January of 2020.
And when it comes to lyrics, is there anything special, or can it be everyday things you write?
Yeah. Lyrics, sometimes it's just you pick up a phrase or you hear it, like when you're kind of like listening to it, and then you just kind of sing something and it sounds like, or you fix it up, or you know, how you're inspired for things like that are always unique, you know, and you can't always explain it. But, you know, when it's good, it's exciting. So then you go with it, you know. Mm. So, and I'm looking forward to collaborating with the guys. Todd's good with songwriting. I've seen his lyrics and the stuff he's done. And I have to, you know, I'm real curious to see what Zach and Brent can do as well, because I like collaborating.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited and looking forward to getting together with those guys creatively. It should be very interesting, because I haven't done a band thing in a long time. And those guys, we all get along great, and we really enjoy each other personally too, which is important, I think.
We hope something, you know, get recorded next year then.
Oh, I'm very confident. Yeah. I will have something. When I put my mind to something, it happens.
Yeah, very good. We mentioned Grand Funk before a few times. You joined them, was it 2000 there somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You mentioned how did you join, and how is it touring with them? Because you're actually playing quite a bit now these days.
It's the 20th year we're starting.
Yeah.
In January, February. It's crazy. We get along. It's great players, of course, to play with. Don Brew is an incredible drummer. Eric Singer loves the way he plays. And, you know, any drummer friend of mine that's seen the band, Corabi always raves about Grand Funk, and he's so angry they're not in the Hall of Fame, but we know how that goes.
Okay? Yeah.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But anyway, Mel is still a tremendous bass player. We have this incredible singer, Max Carl, and keyboard player who sings like a bird, Tim Cashin. It's a great group. We all get along. We do casinos and festivals and outdoor shows and private events, and it's mostly weekend work, which is nice because I could be home, you know. It's a lot of traveling, though. Like I mentioned earlier, I travel to the East Coast a lot for the band. But I enjoy the music. I certainly get to showcase my guitar playing every night. So the Kiss fans that do show up who maybe don't know Grand Funk are going to get quite a bit of Bruce Kulick in the evening, you know, no matter what they think they're going to see. So I'm really been an honor to be involved with these guys all these years, and it's a completely different thing than Kiss. You know, we don't have a big production or anything like that, but the musicianship is very, very high, and the commitment to everybody playing well and the crowd enjoying it is our goal, and we do it very well. So I'm looking forward to whatever more years that Don and Mel are excited to do it, you know. So it's been a fun ride, actually.
But the band is happy we're just playing shows, because I think the last studio album was like 83 or something.
Yeah, they don't seem to. I know I get asked, like, do you want to record? We do some new songs in the set that Max and Don wrote. We used to do a ballad years ago that I wrote with Max and Don, too. But, you know, the show's more a high-energy show, and we didn't really need it. But unless Don and Mel want to do that, you know, it's not my platform to say, we must put out new music. It's really up to them, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you shall never say never, but
right,
you're but out playing, really, having fun.
I'm a supporting player. I'm not the decision maker in Grand Funk. Mm. And I get asked from many of my European fans who love Grand Funk too, why don't you go to Europe? And I know the agency has gotten offers, but I'm not sure Don and Mel want to. They know it's a whole different kind of way of touring over there, and if they don't want to do it, I have to, you know, respect that, you know what I mean. We do some cruises too, just like the Kiss cruise, and those have been fun for the band, but I'm just one of the guys, you know, along for the ride with the band. So
you could say that they do, you know, they're doing it for fun these days. It's not that the commercial touring. It's, you know, just out there giving people a good. Yeah.
It's not like the Kiss tours where you gear up and go for 3 weeks, 3 months, you know, and things like that. We're able to just fly in and out. We have a terrific backline company that brings kind of like our gear, even though we don't own all the amps. It's gear that, you know, I would own. All my guitars are there. Don's drum kit is there. You know, the instruments that we like to play are there. So it makes it kind of easy. But yeah, it really works. This model kind of works for us.
Yeah, so one thing I also noticed now, for example, you're helping Velvet Insane, but you've also been on many different projects through the years. I won't go through everyone, but I'm interested in some, like Don Johnson from Miami Vice. You played guitar on a track, Your Love Is Safe.
God, I don't even remember that.
No, you don't remember. I grew up with Miami Vice, and then I listened to Don Johnson, of course, because he was my little hero then.
that worked with Michael Bolton, knew me. He liked. Yeah. I mean, he did the Johnson record, so all of a sudden I'm playing guitar. I never met him or anything.
No, you just recorded it and it was there.
Exactly.
One guy I have interviewed, you played with, is Graham Bonnet, and in Blackphone he was there too. Do you remember anything at that work?
Graham actually asked me to play some bass because Kevin Valentine was working with him, who's a drummer who did a little work with Kiss as well, and he knew I liked to play bass, and I'm not even sure who they had for guitar, but I love playing bass, and they knew I played some bass on Kiss records and solo records. So I only did some bass sessions for that for those projects, I think. It was fun, though.
Yeah, and we have a band in Finland that won the Eurovision 2006, Lordi.
Yeah.
And you played...
Oh, I love Tommy from Lordi. He's such a wonderful guy. He's a hardworking character. And when they asked... I heard about them on the Eurovision thing and the whole thing. It was exciting to be involved with them. I have one of their multi-platinum Finland awards on my wall here in the room that I'm talking to you and I'm looking at it. Yep. So, no, great guys. Great, fun music. I really like those guys. Tommy's a really, really great guy. I'm very, very happy that I had the opportunity to work with him.
Yeah, I can say that also. You know, Eurovision was usually just pop and disco, but when they won, the following years there was a lot of rock bands, mostly soft rock, but still. So it changed a bit. Another you mentioned before, Thomas Sammet, you played with his project Avantasia. Some.
Yeah, he's. You know, Tobias actually knew Eric very well because Eric. This was during some of the years that he wasn't in Kiss. He actually went to Germany and recorded an album with Tobias. And I remember him mentioning, oh, he's a big Kiss fan. I bet you'll work with him someday. And the next thing I know, you know, I remember him coming to L.A. With his I don't remember if it was his wife yet, but he came with a woman that I think he married. And Lisa, my wife now, and Tobias and his girl, we all went. There was a Grand Funk gig outside of L.A. called in Bakersfield, which is a real cow town. You know? And we all went together. And it was pretty funny for him to be at a California country fair, if you know what I mean. But Tobias is good people, too. He's a really great guy, really talented. And he sang on my BK3. And I did some session work for him, of course. Probably three of his Avantasia records. And I remember him coming to California a couple of years ago. I got to see his producer usually plays guitar with him. I'm forgetting his name, Sasha, I think. Very talented guy, too. So no, good people, really good people. I'm really always quite happy to work with other musicians who I like as people and have a lot of talent. It's always fun. And the more the merrier, you know.
Yeah, and the Avantasia, there's a lot of different people on those albums.
Absolutely.
And it's great music and good people.
Absolutely, yeah. I hope he continues, and I hope he still has, continued success.
And one very different thing is that you have a writing credit on a Kanye West song.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. I'm looking at that multi-platinum album right now. Yeah, it just was where he took a Michael Bolton song and he reworked it for that album, and it was quite interesting, but it was a nice credit to have. You know, I know Billy Squire got covered many times, and other artists too, so why not, you know.
And have you heard a song, or is it not? Yeah, not really my kind of music, but you know, I listen to it and it. Okay, it sounds. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not. Kanye actually has some very. Some of his stuff has a lot of melody. He's still a huge artist and controversial, shall I say? Yes, you know.
And any other project you want to mention? As I mentioned, you have been involved with a lot, so I don't go through everything.
I think we covered a lot of ground, my friend.
Yeah.
I think we have. I look forward to lots of exciting things in 2020 that could come up, but I really think you know that, you know, I kind of mentioned I want to record and everything. I'll be doing more dates with Grand Funk, and obviously, I plan on keeping my connections with Kiss strong, and I wish the best, of course, for Velvet Insane. I think that they're a very talented bunch. So, and I'm hoping to come back to Scandinavia. I really miss. I usually do every year some trip to Scandinavia, Norway, Finland, or Sweden, and it hasn't happened in now 3 years. So I'm hoping 2020 I can make it over there. It'd be great.
I just have some small or quick questions in the end. Do you like sports?
Or? I'm not a big sports guy. occasionally, when a local team's doing well, I'll be supportive.
But not ice hockey or American football or nothing special.
I do have somebody that got me some great opportunity to see the Golden Knights, which is the big team here.
Yeah,
you know, in Vegas, so I enjoy it, but I'm not like particularly a huge sport guy. That's all.
Which country has the best food and drink when you're out touring, do you think?
I love Italian food. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'd have to say Italy, because you can get amazing food even at the gas station. You know what I mean? I do know about your pitti panna. It's pretty good. I like
that. Yeah, I call anything you put in, you know, on the frying pan. Pitti panna can be anything. If you have leftovers, put it together and you have something to eat.
We had some good Swedish friends, especially when I was touring with Union there. And then we got introduced to all your interesting, fun cuisine. And most of Europe has great food. And I do like Scandinavian, you know, certain Scandinavian dishes. But if you're going to ask, really, my favorite is always Italian.
Yeah.
You know? So Italy has a tremendous cuisine there, really. And I know tonight, because I have family in town, we're all going to a nice Italian place, a pretty famous one that's supposed to be related to the Rat Pack, you know, and Sinatra and those guys. Would go to, so it's going to be fun to
hit
another.
Yeah. Do you have an IKEA in Las Vegas?
We do.
Yeah. You can get IKEA. Swedish meatballs there.
Like your Swedish meatballs.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, the last one. Big arena, country fair, or small club? You have played them all, I know.
Yes, I have. What do I prefer?
Yeah, what's the fun? Or what's the fun with everyone? Because I guess you like them all, you know, in their way.
It's kind of interesting, and it's a great question. Honestly, you know, whenever you perform, it doesn't matter if it's in a small venue or a really huge arena, you hope to connect with the people. But there is a difference in the dynamics in a very small room compared to an arena. I mean, you got to be bigger than life, of course, at the arena to reach all those people in the back, which is something that obviously the Kiss guys know. Like, you know, they're so incredible at that, you know. But like last year, we did Grand Funk. We did quite a few dates opening for Bob Seger, and there I am in the big arenas, like the arenas I played with Kiss and all. And it's always really exciting. So I'll always say that. The big places are very, very exciting because you realize you're communicating with large amounts of people. Okay, but as a performer, it really doesn't matter if I'm in a more intimate thing venue. I could be in a place that's smaller, and it's still important to me to play well and to have the people enjoy it. The only negative, no matter where you play, is if people are acting like they don't care. You know what I mean? And I have to admit that rarely happens in my career, fortunately, because I play with some you know, big enough artist that the people are going to give you the attention. But that's always a struggle for an artist when you're just not getting, you don't know if they're listening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You want them to pay attention and enjoy the music. So, because it means a lot for a performer to be up there on stage. Generally, they're traveling a long distance to be there, and there's a lot of preparation that goes into it. So love your performers, people listening. Show them that you love them, because even the most famous people want to know that. Like the time I told Ringo Starr, oh, I enjoy your new album, you know, when I met him in 2010. Mm. And he genuinely looked me in the eye and said, thank you. And I'm going, like, here's probably the most famous drummer in the world, you know, needed some affirmation from me, you know, needed to know that I listened to his new record and liked it. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So performers are all like that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, no one really does it just for, you know, they do it and want confirmation that it's good. You know, they like it, at least, I guess. Is that for most people in life? Okay, we talked over an hour, so is it anything you want to add to this? Anything for the Bruce fans, Kiss fans, Grand fans, any fans, and all the stuff?
Well, just, you know, I'm pretty active with social media, so please keep in touch with the my official Facebook page, and then, of course, Instagram and Twitter. And I do have a really cool new website called, actually, it was a Scandinavian Norwegian guy that gifted it to me, because I didn't have BruceKulick.com, and now I have BruceKulick.com. Mm. Okay. The old Kulick.net is still attached to it, but really the new site is BruceKulick.com. So visit my website, and I'm looking forward to more Guitars of the Month, Kiss Guitar of the Month, and other events and things. And like I said, keep in touch. I know that there's so many fans of mine in Sweden that I appreciate so much. So thank you so much for the time, and everybody keep in touch.
Yeah, then I have to thank you a lot. You took your time in Las Vegas, and all well for the future.
Well, thank you so much, too, and happy holidays and everything. Happy New Year.
Yeah, the same.
And, I wish you the best.
The same. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.